extends to Eastloo Quay walking route.
This podcast will highlight several alternative routes to take you into Eastloo. The first is via Shutter Hill and Station Road. The second is via Bayview Road, the Walldown and the South West Coast Path to the seafront. The third is via Barbican Hill, Belinda Lane, known locally as the Zigzag, to 4th Street. And the fourth is via Barbican Hill and Tower Hill to Higher Market Street. From the Loo Gateway sign, head a short distance eastward to the first junction and take the first turning left. At the sign, take a short detour down the lane to your right to St Martin's Church. The church is dedicated to St Martin of Tours, a Roman soldier who cut his cloak in half to give to a beggar. St Martin's Church, Eastloo, is predominantly a medieval building with vestiges of earlier Norman stonework still visible in its fabric, the most obvious of which is the doorframe surrounding the north door. Local historian John Southern highlights the many historical features of Loo's parish church.
The north doorway is a lovely Norman doorway, in a reasonable state of preservation because for many years it's been sheltered by a porch, so it's kept the weather off it. It has intricate mouldings. The tympanum is more modern. I think that was filled in a much later date. And of course you've got the lovely early English doorway on the west of side in the tower. Where you walk into the church and you are then under its crowning glory, which is its 16th century wagon roof. And then the stained glass is nearly all modern, all Munich glass, apart from some little medieval fragments in one of the top tracery of one of the windows in the St. Francis Chapel. In the north window, it's a memorial window to Ronald Bainton Picken, who was in the RAF, or in the Royal Flying Corps in those days. He was killed over Abyssinia, and this plane is represented in the top left-hand corner of the window. Some of you may be interested in the dedication of the church. The old dedication from medieval times, probably for the previous church which stood on the site, and was of Saint Cain, K-A-Y-N-E, not Keen as we say today, it's with a A. She was Saint Cain of the Virgin. And then back in, I believe it would be in about 1300s, it was to St. Martin of Tours. He was the one who cut his cloak in half and gave half to a beggar so that he would keep himself warm.
Coming back up the lane, taking great care, cross the road to the pedestrian path on the other side of the road. You can see the polytunnels of the nursery through the trees. This nursery's name, Pendrim, betrays the historical significance at the time of the Domesday Book of the Manor of Pendrim, which included much of the site of modern-day Eastloo. It was held by William the Conqueror as part of his own demesne, and came to be managed by the Bodrigan family. The flower beds and decorated boats on St Martin's Corner are maintained by a band of hard-working local volunteers called Loo in Bloom. Like many seaside towns, Loo excels when it comes to flower displays. Loo in Bloom plant, water and maintain most of the flowers displays in and around Loo. Penny Waters tells us about Loo in Bloom.
When coming into the towns of East and West Loo, you will see the boats filled with flowers. Once in the town, there are more flowers in beds and baskets, both summer and winter. These are put up and maintained by a group called Loo in Bloom. Just a group of people who get together to keep the town looking bright and cheerful. Many visitors comment on the flowers in Loo, and the locals feel that the summer is really here when the summer displays go up. Of course, there's a lot more to it than just putting up boxes and baskets. Over 400 pieces are put up, watered, fed throughout the summer, and are removed in one sweep in October before the winter planting is done. Lewin Bloom was started some 20 years or so ago by a group of enthusiasts who started the ball rolling. We have entered Britain in Bloom many times in the past and have received various awards, silver, silver gilt and a special award for exceptional effort. We've also run local competitions which were fiercely contested. When you walk around Lou, you might well see one of our vans decorated with flowers, buzzing about, keeping the displays up to scratch. Every morning our waterers go out very early and make sure that even though it's rained, the plants still have some water and feed.
Walkers now need to cross the road again to the pavement on the right-hand side of the road, taking care to look and listen for cars. The road rises gently to an area known as Sunrising to Lou Community Academy. To the right of the school car park is a lane, which is the start of Shutter Hill, which ends opposite Lou Railway Station. Shutter, on the steep hillside over East Lou, is known to have been inhabited by the 12th century and is thought to have been the original settlement in the area, hidden from the perils of the sea up the Lou River. John Southern will take you down Shutter Hill to Station Road.
Well, when you're down at Shutter, it's a hamlet built on a steep hill. Its name signifies Shooter, which what you was Shooter, S-H-O-O-T-A, as far as we know, which signified the chute of water, which is still there. The water, I believe, at one time drove a mill, and then in much later, it fed the water tower in the railway station. There's some interest in families there. There were the Menhennicks and the Tuckers and the Jeffreys. They ran the carriers, they had wagons, they were blacksmiths, they were wheelwrights. It was a very busy industrial site. And of course, for the private inhabitants, there was to me Colonel Mole, Lieutenant Colonel William Vincent Mole. Sorry, Vincent William Mole, M-O-U-L. He lived in Shutter from after the Irish Troubles. He retired. He was Assistant Provost at Dublin. And he was responsible for bringing Sir Roger Casement back from Ireland, where he was captured, where he in this country he was tried and subsequently hung for treason. Robert Casement, a long time ago now, in the 20s, I believe, he was in Germany recruiting Irish people to fight for the German cause. And his black diaries were notorious at the time, and they really went against him a lot. Colonel Mole sat in a Victorian room, heavy with furniture, but on one wall was all the artefacts of his military career. There was the flag of the Cheshire Regiment. I remember it as a boy, seeing it many times. And there was a Union Jack, the actual Union Jack that flew over the post office in Dublin during the besieging in the 1920s. And he also had Sir Roger Casement's own pistol, his private, bejeweled-handled pistol, which hung on the wall. I've held it. Casement gave it to him when he was arrested. He handed it over to Mole.
Hello, my name's Mark Camp, manager of the Tourist Information Centre. Although not Lou-born, I grew up here in Shutter, an area we thought of as separate to the rest of Lou. Historically it is. It's the earliest settlement on the east side of the river. Shutter was, and still is, hidden away from the coast. It's sheltered from the wind, and unseen by any pirates or brigands sailing up and down the coast. It also had a fresh water supply running down through it, hence the name Shutter. Even in the 40 years I have been in Lou, Shutter has changed. Houses have been built in the fields all the way down the left-hand side, where as children we played cowboys and Indians or sledged in those winters cold enough for snow. On the right, where Mr. Jennings had his market gardens up until the early 1980s, houses have also been built, but not in such close proximity. The car park that you reach on the left-hand side was the nearest we got to a level playground, a place to play football when there weren't too many cars parked. It had, I believe, been the reservoir for the railway at the bottom of the hill in the days of steam, and we reckoned there was still water underneath the tarmac. The little house opposite, known as Cobb Walls, is possibly one of the oldest houses still standing in Lou. The gardens behind, although now built in, still contain many apple trees, a remnant of the cider orchards once found all over the area. How many times have I chased a football down this hill, or run down after school to see who can reach the station first. Of course, the downside was you had to walk up it as well, every day to school, rain or shine. You're lucky, you can probably catch a bus back up later. At the bottom, you reach the Globe Inn, the nearest we get to a station hotel. I will let Ray, the old station master, take over here, and see you again later by the bridge.
The Lou Valley Railway Line is an important transport link for the town and one of the most beautiful journeys in the country from the market town of Liscard following the East Lou River. Ray Pettifer was the last station master who will track the beginnings of the line when it transported stone and minerals from the mines of Carradon Hill to the modern day transporter of commuters and visitors.
I am the last station master of Lou. Came here in 1959. It was a small but busy station then, with steam-operated trains. It had been a mineral line first, running from on the moors above Liscard down to the quay for moving minerals and taking stuff away from the quay up as far as Liscard. But the line wasn't connected to Liscard then. It ran up through the valley and right up on the moors, where you'll see part of it up there, then you can see viaducts or bridges, embankments still there. Well, then the Great Western bought it and they made a link which links up to Liscard from the line. So the train has to reverse when it gets part way up and up the steep bank to Liscard station to connect with the main line. They don't go onto the main line, it stops at Liscard and you have to get out the train and move and catch the main line trains. We used to have a mineral goods train came down every other day, and that went down on the quay, crossing the road by the bridge. And that, of course, restricted the parking on the quay. So, say, we went every other day down there, and we used the parking yard for car parking in the summer. Pierce's bus company used to have connections with the train to run to Polperro and deliver the goods to Polperro. We had our own lorry here in Lou, which delivered the goods around Lou. The service in the summer, the railway owned fair-sized steamers which connected with the liners that went into Plymouth. But in the summer, they would occasionally run to Lou, bringing people from Plymouth down with return tickets. They could return by train if they wished, and vice versa, could come down on the train and go back on the steamer. During the summer months, when it used to get busy, especially a Sunday, the train would be swamped coming from Plymouth. So we could add, with the steam train, we could add coaches on at Liscard and bring the Plymouth people down. So that worked very well. But you had to be prepared with having coaches to run down. And the steam train came down and it had to reverse down at Lou. And we took the whole train down in the yard. And there was a loop down there, what we called a loop of line. So the engine disconnected and run around the other side, then pulled back into Lou, where we had a water tower. We called it a water tower, a big tank which supplied the water for the engines. This was because we had a reservoir up at Shutter, which was up beside the Globe Hotel, which was railway owned. So they had free water down here. So that's why they took it here rather than Liscard. It cut it all down. We had an instrument, if you understand, signalling for a single line safety thing, connected to Coombe Junction electrically with bell codes we used to use. So the trains obviously couldn't crash then. The instrument would only allow one tablet instrument out each end of the line. So you couldn't possibly have two trains on the line. Very safe working. But we used to get snags at times where the high spring tides would flood the line between Lou and Terrace Crossing, which is a little crossing about a mile or so out of Lou, where the line was rather low. Well, you couldn't run the steam train over much water because the water would go up in the firebox and put the fire out. So they would phone me and say they couldn't get down, and then we'd have to hire a coach to run the passengers up and down. You could look across, especially high tide. It was lovely to see the woods across going up East Lou River. These were quite attractive, but the tide used to go out a lot, as you know, in Lewis at Tidal Harbour. And they used to let a load of doodlebugs out, little self-drive motorboats, with people who on a holiday, no idea with boats. And they'd drive up the river, and we used to watch these and the tides going out, and they get stuck on the bank in the middle of the river, the mud bank. And you see them sat in the boat with the engine going full bore. But we could also watch right over to Westlow. You could look right down the river. It's a very attractive area. And you could look and see the harbour right down. The bridge when I came here was single traffic. They doubled that up when I first came here. So that was nice to watch all this building a bridge. They widened the bridge, doubled it. So that was attractive, doing that. We had a slipway on the station yard where we used to pull boats up in the war years, because there's a boatyard across, Perns. That was an active boatyard when I was here. They used to build MLs, they called them, motor launches for the Navy. And they would build the hulls there and float them under the bridge and then finish the top bit down where the fishing boats are now. And that was all fenced off. So that was quite a busy thing in the war. Three boatyards then, one up where Jewson's, I think they're called. They got a big shed up there. That was a boatyard, and there was one further up again, which has all disappeared. So there were a lot of herons in those days, used to nest in the trees opposite there. But they've moved on now, and egrets have come in and taken over.
The station is located at the confluence of the East and West Loo rivers. This area may have been the inspiration for the name of Loo, originating from the Cornish loch, which means pool or inlet. Over the water, you can see the Millpool Boating Lake, and in the distance, Kilmarnock Woods, and the heronry bordering the West Loo River at Trenant Point. From the station, follow the river downstream towards the bridge. The bridge that spans the river now has seven arches over the water and was widened in 1959. The original bridge was several metres downstream from the existing bridge past the War Memorial. A stone in the low wall bordering the car park marks that spot.
The bridge you see here today, joining Westlow to Eastlow, was built in the 1850s and replaced an earlier bridge a little further downstream.
Here's Mark Camp talking about the original bridge and the contribution Loo's residents made in two world wars.
Loo may be one united town these days, officially, but for many years East and West Loo were two separate towns, both sending two MPs to Parliament. The bridge may have linked the two, but it didn't mean you had to cross it. The earliest record of a bridge we have comes from the 1400s, when the people of Loo were granted permission to build a bridge by the Bishop of Exeter. To keep in with the church, the bridge had a chapel to St Anne halfway across. This bridge survived in various guises until 1689, when substantial repairs had to be made, this work being marked by plaques on both sides of the river, which you can still see. By the mid-1800s, the bridge was once again in such a state that it was decided to build a new bridge. To do this, an Act of Parliament had to be passed, and from this the Loo Harbour Commissioners were formed. This new bridge has been widened and strengthened over the years, as have the links between East and West Loo. There is still some rivalry between the Sunnyside and the Moneyside, but by and large we all get on quite well these days. Please cross the road on the bridge using the controlled crossing point and walk down to the War Memorial. I will meet you there. Being a port, Loo men have always been called upon to defend the country. The First World War was no exception. It's hard to say exactly how many, but figures would suggest that around 1,000 men from Loo and the adjacent parishes went off to war between 1914 and 1918. Fortunately, a large percentage of those brave men returned, but some were not so lucky. Their names are inscribed here on the War Memorial, along with those that have died in later conflicts, and are remembered each November by the people of Loo. The memorial was unveiled on the 14th of May 1921 and displays the names of 35 men who died as a result of the First World War. There was much discussion as to where it should be sited. Those in West Loo wanted it their side of the river. Some even suggested it placing it in the middle of the bridge. Some said that by placing it here, it would remind people of the tragedy of war at a time when they should be enjoying their holidays. What do you think? I believe we should never be allowed to forget the sacrifice these people made, and would like to tell you the story of just two names on the memorial. Arnold Geach had signed up to be a gunner at the start of the war in 1914. During training, he was stationed, like many of the Loo boys, at Pendennis Castle, Falmouth, and on November the 21st took part in a route march out around the countryside opposite Falmouth. He returned to the quayside later that afternoon, and at that point details about what happened become unclear. It seems the young lad fell into the water, but how and why was never decided. Geach's body was not found until 3 weeks later, floating in the sea off Pendennis Point. He was only 17 years old. Samuel Honey, like many West Loo boys, was a Naval Reserve volunteer. At the age of 19, he found himself serving as a signalman on the former White Star liner Laurentec. It was his first voyage, having just completed his training, and had been home on leave in Loo only a week before, playing the organ at the Wesleyan Church. On the 23rd of January 1917, the Laurentec left Liverpool and headed out into the freezing North Atlantic, bound for Halifax, Nova Scotia. After a brief stop on the Irish coast, she pressed on out into the ocean, but had not gone far before she hit a newly laid minefield. The ship stood no chance and sunk with a loss of over 350 men. Those that weren't killed immediately died of exposure in the icy waters. Samuel Honey was one of those men. He was almost certainly unaware of the importance of the journey the ship was making. Hidden in her baggage room was approximately 35 tons of gold bullion, worth at the time over £5 million, and to be used as payment for munitions in Canada. The salvage operation started later that year, and it took over 7 years to bring all the gold up, the greatest amount ever to be brought up from a shipwreck.
From the war memorial, the trail leads along 4th Street, the core of the town centre, with shops selling gifts, homeware, several bakeries, photographic goods, sweets, jewellery, books and stationery, ice cream, shoes and groceries. There is a delicatessen, two chemists, banks, estate agents, coffee shops, a post office, several pubs and restaurants. In the centre of the town is the Tourist Information Centre and Guildhall Clock Tower, and two of the oldest buildings in East Loo. The Golden Guinea is one of them.
Oh, well, I wouldn't be a sailor lad.
Here's Captain Neil Birchwood Harper, who's a former master mariner, telling us about the restaurant.
The building which now houses the Golden Guinea restaurant, dating from 1632, was once the residence of Thomas Bond. He was the historian of Loo and wrote a book about East and West Loo in 1823. Thomas was town clerk of Loo for 50 years. His grandfather and great-grandfather both served as mayor. In later life, Thomas was regarded as the most important man in both East and West Loo. The restaurant takes its name from a quantity of gold coins found hidden on the premises.
And it's home, boys, home. Home I'd like to be, home for a while.
Just past the Golden Guinea is the Ship Inn and the Salutation Pubs. At the Salutation, turn right under the arch next to the Tony Martin's Antiques Dealers. This alleyway leads to the harbour side, known as Granite Quay, and the ferry steps. Loo resident Ivor Toms talks about the distinctive inscription made out of pebbles on the front of the shop and Loo's history as a trading port for granite and minerals.
Home I'd like to be, home for a while.
But it started at the bottom of Barbican Hill, which was the main road into Loo for many, many years. At the bottom is the Ship Hotel, which must have been a staging house for the people travelling through Loo, stopping overnight. Opposite is the Salutation, which is a wonderful pub, one of the oldest in Loo, I would think, with a slate floor which slopes towards the quay. It's full of pictures of the old fishermen, fishing boats, and it was the main place for all the shark fishing fraternity. They all used to end up in there after being out at sea all day, you know. Next to that is the antique shop, Tony Martin's, which, when I was a boy, was a shoe shop, which belonged to Reg Toms and Jack Toms. In the street side, under the window, it's been cemented with stones from the beach. In amongst this, if you look carefully, you can see the name Toms, which sort of jumps out at you after a while, you know. And next to this is the archway, a wonderful feature which runs straight out to the quay. If you go under the arch and straight out to the quay, Before you get to the ferry steps on the quay, on the right-hand side is a new building, which used to be the granite works. This had a terrific history of cutting granite from cheese ring, which ended up all over the world. Calcutta docks, lighthouses, in actual fact, London Bridge, the one they sold to America, a lot of it was made on the quay in Loo. And from there you turn down the quay, and there used to be a big crane on the quay, wooden crane, next to the diesel. This is gone now, but that's where they used to load the big schooners, which went all over the world, you know, carrying granite. And also they used to have a railway came down there with copper ore, china clay, granite, everything. It was a really industrious place at Loo at one time, you know. It was so important, they had two MPs, one for East Loo, one for West Loo.
The harbour side that once thronged to the sound of Cornwall's industrial past now specialises in fishing trips, coastal excursions and local food and drink. Now a renowned restaurant, the Old Sail Loft, was once a sail loft and chandler's. Loo resident, born and bred Edwina Hannaford, talks about her grandfather's career as a sailmaker and her family's maritime links.
Well, I do remember my granddad. He was 92 when he died, when I was 11 years old. But these memories really come from my mum, Mary Shaw. She told me that the old sail loft, which is now a restaurant, upstairs he used to make his sails, and downstairs was a chandlery. Of course, this is back in the days when sail ruled the world, so there was no engines to get out of the harbour. You either rowed out or hoped you had a favourable wind. He used some very distinctive tools for his job. One was a leather palm that protected his hand from when he was sewing with these gigantic needles. And the other one was called a fid, which is a long conical-shaped tool for making the holes along the edge of the sail. And this was made out of heartwood, extremely hard. And my mum as well has lent all his tools to the Old Town Museum, so you can actually see his implements in the museum in Higher Market Street. Because there was no engines in the boats, they had to actually physically row. And I think there's some really good photographs in the museum of boats actually rowing out. And this is fishing boats, as well as quite large trading boats as well. There was one called the Florence, which my great-grandfather helped to build. And I read a report in a newspaper from the late 1800s, which said, the counter stern of the Florence nearly knocked over a gas lamp on the side of the quay. It was so tight turning in the river. You know, this is a vessel that was, 100 feet. It was huge, much, much bigger than the fishing vessels you have these days, which are perhaps, 40 foot. So I believe there are 1,000 people in Loo employed in boat building and allied trades back in the 20th and 19th century. I mean, it was a huge, huge business, and skills were passed on from father to son, from grandfather, right the way through the generations. As you walk down past the fish quay, you come to a bit of the harbour side that's always known as Granite Quay. I believe that this was perhaps where the deepest draft vessels could moor, and they loaded up with granite that came down from the mines at Carradon, inland just north of Liscard. But it's still referred to as Granite Quay now.
This is now the end of this walking tour. There are others on the website.